Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love. Coming to you wherever you may be. Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where our today's guest is Sally Hepworth, who is joining us from Australia, where it is now 9 o'clock in the morning. So we just know that it's 9 o'clock tomorrow. So we know tomorrow is going to happen because Sally's already proven to us it is going to be there. We're going to be talking to her about her new latest thriller, The Good Sister, which is, as of a couple of hours ago, we just learned, the New York Times best-selling book, The Good Sister. And we are so excited for her. This is her first time on the New York Times list. She's been on the top of our list for a very long time. I have been behind Sally's books since the very first one, which I picked as a Book Reporter Bets On selection, and I've selected each of them since then. So I'm really glad that the Times caught up to me today. I'm very excited that they finally realized also how fabulous your work is. I usually read books in order when they're coming out. Like I have a stack that's done by date, but I will confess that when Sally's books come in, it moves to the top of the stack, even if it's not coming out for months, because I am always trying to figure out what she has done this time round. So I'm looking forward to this. Last time we talked was in my office in November 2019, and we had a blast. So now I'm looking forward to this. So welcome, Sally. So nice to have you here.
Oh, it's so nice to be here. And thank you for all that support over the years. And, you know, it is so nice that we were able to meet each other and I could come into your office. And it just, and now it's great to be here today.
And now we can just beam across the time zones. It's like totally perfect. Totally perfect. So tell us about The Good Sister, because I want you to tell us the description, because I'm afraid I'll give something away. So go for it.
Well, The Good Sister, it's not a spoiler to say that it is about sisters. You can probably pick that up from the title. And it's about twin sisters, Fern and Rose, who are incredibly close, not just because they're sisters, but also because they've shared a pretty turbulent, pretty terrible childhood together. But at the start of the book, they have moved past that childhood and they are leading successful lives, but they are carrying with them a terrible secret from that childhood. So at the beginning of the book, they're 28. Fern is a single librarian, which is my favorite profession in the world. And she is also possibly on the autism spectrum, although she hasn't been diagnosed. And she suffers from sensory processing difficulties, which cause her to lead a fairly narrow, fairly structured life, and also to lean quite heavily on her sister Rose in order to lead that life. Then we have Rose, who is maybe the responsible sister. She is married, she has a great job, she has the house with the white picket fence, and she has plans to have a baby as soon as she can. And so the story really starts to take off when Fern discovers that Rose cannot have the baby that she yearns for. And she takes it upon herself to pay her sister back for everything she's done for her by trying to have a baby for her. And this decision, and it takes her on a journey that opens up her world in new and exciting ways, and leads her to a new love interest called Wally. And it takes her to some heartwarming places, but it also takes her back to some quite sinister places from her childhood, and forces her to examine the life that she's known so far, and also that secret that she has been carrying since she was a child. So that is the elevator pitch for The Good Sister.
Now, doesn't that sound great? Don't you just want to get off the elevator and go get the book? Because I read it and now I want to go reread it after hearing that description. So the inspiration for your last book, The Mother-in-Law, was your father-in-law. Like we've had that discussion. So who was the inspiration for this book? What, are there family members that were the inspiration here too?
It's always a family member. There's just endless family members to investigate through fiction. But in this case, it was my daughters, because I have to make the admission that I don't have a sister myself, which I feel a little sheepish about because I've written a book about sisters. But I can explain. I have actually been fascinated by the sister relationship my whole life. I have two older brothers who are twins, which explains the twin interest, but no sisters. But my mum is one of five sisters. All my best girlfriends have got at least one sister. And I have more recently become the mother of two daughters. And they were the ones that inspired this book. There was a little moment where it happened, And it was going back a couple of years now. It was a beautiful Australian summer's day, and I was watching them play in the garden. And they were playing really nicely, which is, you know, usually it's not that common around here, Carol. So I was feeling good. I thought, hey, maybe I'll go inside and make a drink. Maybe I'll go and do something for myself. But as soon as I'd finished even formulating that thought, the squeals of joy turned to those other kind of nasty kind of squeals that say that someone's been injured. So I went to investigate, and I found my older daughter, Eloise, with a ring of teeth marks in her upper arm. And Clementine, who was two at the time, was looking kind of guilty. And she's got one of those expressive faces that it doesn't, it's not hard to tell what has happened. And so I went to reprimand my two-year-old, and not particularly harshly. I mean, she's got us all wrapped around her little finger. So I was just kind of reprimanding her for the biting. But before I could get the words out, Eloise, who's the injured party, my six-year-old, stepped in between Clementine and me and said to me, "Don't you yell at my baby sister." And I was so confused, because as someone with older brothers, them getting into trouble was among the great joys of my childhood. In fact, even to this day, when mum tells them off, happy days. And yet here's my daughter, teeth marks in her arm, and she doesn't want her sister to get in trouble. And I was making the mistake of thinking how beautiful that was and what a beautiful sisterly relationship they had, when she then added, "Don't worry, mummy, I'll get her back later when she least expects it." I just thought, wow, sisters, right? Like, and it's so, there is this incredible love and protection and loyalty, but there's also this cunning and this kind of protectiveness that says that you can't hurt my sister, but I can. Mm-hmm. And I walked away from that, and I came into my office, and I had my notebook here, and I was looking for a new book idea, and I just wrote down sisters ? And that was the beginning of it.
That was the beginning. So if those two didn't have a skirmish outside and you didn't observe it, who knows what you would have written about? You'd have to go to another family member, you know?
I'm
expecting somebody else. Well, I really love the dedication is for Eloise and Clementine for giving me a glimpse into the great wonders and greater horrors of having a sister. Did it take a long time to craft that line? That dedication is just dead on perfect.
No, that one came to me just like that. It was very clear who this book belonged to because of that moment. And you know, it was only ever going to be them. I dedicated my book, The Family Next Door, to my son, Oscar. So I knew that it would eventually come around to them. But when it was about sisterhood, it was a no-brainer.
It was their turn for sure. So did you have a challenge, because you don't have a sister? I mean, you've observed other people with sisters. Writing about the sibling relationship, was it something, I mean, you're watching those two, but they're little at this point. They haven't been a lot of what your characters end up going through. Was that challenging to do?
Yes and no. It was, in the sense that you can't kind of put yourself exactly in that situation. And I could think about my relationship with my brothers, but as I said, I know that that is a different, we're incredibly close too, but it feels like brother-sister is a less complex relationship in a general sense. And I think that part of the reason that I felt like I could do it was that I have always had a fascination with sisters, and I'm an observer anyway. You know, I think every writer is, and familial relationships are my favorite to observe. I love the dysfunctionality of it. But like I said, my mum is one of five sisters, and my mum is the nicest person in the world. I mean, she does not have a bad word to say about anyone. She is, you know, the peacemaker. She's just gorgeous. And yet when she talks about her sisters, and the love is incredible, but she will often kind of, it's the one person she can be, or one group of people that she can be a bit wicked about. And sometimes they'll get together with one of them and talk about the other one, or, you know, and I imagine vice versa. And so I have always spectated on this relationship, and I've always wanted to know more about it. There was another incident that kind of inspired this story, which would be obvious when I tell you. It was a conversation I had with my girlfriends, all of whom have got a sister, about 10 years ago. And we were on our way down to a girls' weekend. We were in the car together, five of us, and a conversation started about babies. we were all either pregnant or had just had a baby or were trying to have a baby, and whether or not you would donate an egg to someone. And the conversation, you know, we love, you know, women, we love those kind of hypothetical conversations, digging deep into, you know, what we would do. And everyone in the car said that they would donate an egg to their sister. And I said I wouldn't donate an egg to anyone because I had my son at that point, and I just thought I couldn't separate the fact that he was my egg. And so and any egg I donated, it would be my child going out into the world. And everyone agreed that the reason I couldn't do it is because I didn't have a sister. And all of the people in the car would donate an egg only to their sister. And so that kind of whet my appetite even more for this relationship, this idea that I didn't fully understand it, but I knew there was something going on there. And I knew there was some, I knew that this bond was incredible and unlike anything else. And so when I write about these characters, and often I write about relationships or afflictions or diseases that I don't understand and that I haven't experienced myself, you really find that by stepping into the character's shoes as you do and seeing through their eyes and, you know, taking all the experience that you have and the things that you've observed and just putting it into that character's perspective. And my aim is not to represent sisters everywhere and every single sisterly relationship, but I kind of felt like with all the ones I'd observed, I would be able to represent Fern and Rose. So I hope I did.
No, you completely did. You know, first of all, they're completely different. And it's really interesting to see it. Yeah. Twins that are so drastically different. Fern is so regimented, and we see that right up from the front. And it was so much fun. It was to picture her day and see how she sees the world. Like, you actually write down, this is what happens, this is what happens, this is what happens. And I kept thinking about, after I read it, how she would see daily occurrences. Fern would walk in the room and go, the laptop is on the table, the screen is open, the person is there. And she almost narrates her own life. How much fun was it creating her? And just, you know, because she's so dead on, and you know how she's going to feel. Like, you just know she's going to be really involved in something.
Yeah. Oh, she was a joy to create. I think of all of the characters I've written, Fern has been my favorite. And the beautiful thing about her was that I didn't really have to do a lot of research for her because I have a neurodiverse family. My son is on the spectrum and has sensory processing disorder. My daughter has ADHD. You know, my husband's on the spectrum. So we have this is our world. This is what we kind of live with every day. And so it really was freeing to me as a writer that I could step into that world without kind of looking at the books for a list of traits, you know, because I feel like while you have to, and as a writer, you have a responsibility to research if you're going to write about something that you don't know, it lends you sometimes into a trap of putting too much information about whatever it is you're researching and not enough character. And because I didn't have to do that, I felt like everything was about Fern and who she was. And she wasn't meant to represent everyone in the, you know, neuroatypical community. She was just Fern. And the fact that she was possibly on the spectrum, she had sensory processing disorder, was the least interesting thing about her, you know, it just was what it was. But it really was nice to be able to include some of my world on the page in a way that the things that impressed me, for example, last night, my son said to me, because I was taking phone calls, and he said, why, when you answer the phone to your girlfriends, as opposed to other, you know, your voice goes really high, you know, like, hi. And it's that stuff that you don't notice that you do yourself. And yet when he says that, I knew exactly what he meant. And he had worked out who I was talking to, judging by the pitch of my voice. And there are things like that that just blow my mind every day. The just kind of, and again, his experience is just that he is just who he is. I'm not suggesting that he is every autistic person, but the magic of having someone on the spectrum in your house and the way that it makes you notice things and almost ridicule yourself with the silly things that you do and just accept, like saying, I ran into someone in the street, and he would say, well, no, you weren't running. And you didn't actually touch them. You just said hello to them. Why are you saying that? And you think, that's true. I don't know why I'm saying that. And one of the things that was important to me with the book is that that was what came across, not that we were laughing at Fern, but in fact, that I hope that neurotypical people will laugh at themselves and about some of the things that we say that make no sense. And it sometimes takes someone with a, you know, a slightly different brain to point out, you know, how funny we are sometimes.
Yeah. And she, when she says things, it's, well, wait a second, why am I doing this? Why am I doing that? But she gets up in the morning and she sees how her day is going to go. I'm going to go here, I'm going to go there. And she explains it to herself up front of, now I'm going to go do this, now I'm going to go do that. My favorite was when she's working, she works at the library and she doesn't want to ever fix the copier or to have anything to do with anything that's mechanical. And the things that she does cleverly to get herself out of doing that was just priceless, because it's like, I'll go hide in this room, I'll go do this. And you realize that everyone around her probably knows what she's doing, but she thinks she's so much smarter than the average bear on this one. Like, just, figured out.
Exactly. And you know, that came from actual librarians, because before COVID, I used to write all my books in the library. Every day I would take my computer and I would go to my local library and I would write there. And so I knew all the librarians and they knew me, and I told them I was writing a book about a librarian, and it was set in that library where I work. And I had the best backstage pass to libraries and librarians. I went on tours of the library, and if ever I was in the middle of a scene and I needed a book recommendation, or I needed to know, you know, hey, what's something that you librarians do that normal people wouldn't know about, I could just grab one of them and say, hey, what about this? And so that was a really fun piece of creating a librarian character. But when I asked them, what is the part, sorry, that's my dog snoring. And I tried to kick her out, but she then scratched on the door. So it was snoring or scratching. So when I said to them, what's the worst part of being a librarian? You know, there must be bad parts about it. And I probably asked 10 librarians that question, and they all said printers and photocopiers.
I love it. But you think about it, it's like somebody comes up and goes, it doesn't work. And now it's their problem to go fix it. If the paper didn't come out, either that, or I used to go because it was like 5 cents a copy and you'd put your money in and then it wouldn't work. And then they'd have to figure out how to refund you your money, but you still didn't have your copies. And it was, I could understand how that would probably be the worst thing for them. And her trying to not do this in every single way. It's like your turn to go on the copier. I'm not going to do that.
Well, and that was what I had noticed, that whenever someone walked up to the desk about the photocopiers, all of the librarians would sort of find themselves suddenly busy, you know, and kind of walk away. And I thought, I know, I think Fern would have worked this out, you know, because she would know what was happening and she would get out of it. So that part came very clearly to me.
And I also like her boss, and she's saying, you know, the other woman who had been the boss before read all the books in the library, and you have not read all the books in the library. The woman goes, this is a bigger job than that. That's not the only thing you have to do. But that person, that was her job. And I just love it, because she saw everything through right and wrong. Like, this is the way you do it, this isn't the way you do it. And she was just such a wonderful character, as because you could really see the way she was working everything through, but she also was very clever on what she didn't want to do, and she's going to figure out how to get out of it. Like, how to work her way away, you know? Even bringing the little dogs in the library. Bring the dogs. Dogs are not allowed in the library. But there's a reason that I could do. And she could reason her way out of everything, which was so much fun to read.
Yes, exactly. And that was important, because I often hear people say that people on the spectrum, especially high-functioning Asperger's, or what's used to call Asperger's, they'll say, oh, they're rule followers, you know, they do what they're told, they, you know, to the letter of the law. And I don't like generalizations about people on the spectrum. Once you've met one person on the spectrum, you've met one person on the spectrum. You can't speak for the whole community. But when it comes to not, you know, following the rules, yes, but also my son's very creative at getting out of things that he doesn't want to do. And, you know, just because they believe in rules doesn't mean that they do everything they don't want to do. In fact, I think that the opposite was true. So I wanted to make Fern, you know, in control of, and not a complete, you know, robot, because that just isn't the case. And she wasn't doing anything she didn't want to do.
No. And I really love that she describes Rose as my person. Yeah. And I think it's such a great way of describing it. They've got the sister relationship, but she's either as my person. So talk to us about how she sees her sister. Like, how does she see her sister? She sees her sister as her protector, her savior, or what?
She sees her sister as her everything. And that is what happens, I think, when you have a world that's small, and it could be for many reasons. And in Fern's case, it was both the traumatic childhood and also her particularly sensory processing difficulties, but, you know, in a larger sense, her autism. And so Rose, well, I need to be careful about what I say and not give away any spoilers, but, you know, really, particularly the fact that they were twins meant that they were incredibly close. They'd shared this childhood together, and Fern was able to create her world that existed with Rose and her husband Owen when he was in the picture, and her job at the library and her karate and her yoga, and that was it. You know, that to her completed the picture. And so there is a discussion in the book where she talks to Wally about a person and explains that, well, it's your person. It's the person that you write down, you know, when you go to the doctor and you need to have a next of kin. It's the person who drives you home if you're not able to drive. That's your person. And I think that was kind of how she understood relationships at that point. And I think over the course of the book, that grows a little bit, and it doesn't have to just be one person. Right. And I think Fern actually, Fern had more people than she thought she did at the start as well.
Yeah, I think she had all those librarians that were right behind her too, because they all loved her. She wouldn't want to go out to lunch and they'd say, come to lunch. She goes, no, I have my sandwich here, and this is what I do, and this is how I do it. And you're going to go, and what's going to happen at the restaurant? And I don't think I'm going to understand. And the way it's written, you feel like if you ran into a person who is somewhere on the spectrum, or someone who's having issues, you will understand. And we say having issues, someone who's different. And you'll now understand a lot more about what's in their head just by reading this book, because it's like, well, they're just seeing it this way. And the one librarian just saying, well, you know, you can come, you can do this. And she's just trying to show her there is another way. And I thought that was a beautiful way of expressing it, as opposed to you're wrong, you should be. It wasn't that. It's like, you can come along. We'd like to have you. And there's a great paragraph about halfway through the book where Fern says, sisterly relationships are so strange in this way. The way I can be mad at Rose, but still want to please her. Be terrified of her, but also want to run to her. Hate her and love her both at the same time. Maybe when it comes to sisters, boundaries are a little blurry. Blurred boundaries, I think that's what sisters do best. And I think that is a line that should be on like a holiday card, because I think it does sum up the way people feel. It's there's this blurred boundaries, but that's what they do. And they'll say things to them that, you know, they wouldn't actually do, you know, you wouldn't say it to somebody else. You'll say it to your sister.
Exactly. And that was definitely what I got from all the relationships that I observed. And in fact, I have a friend who I think did you speak to my friend, Jane Cockrum,
who
also is an author? Yes. She has a sister, and she and I, before the COVID, would write in the library together. And quite often I would write something and I would say, is this true for you and your sister? You know, she kind of became the guinea pig of whether things were true. And she, I remember that line and her saying, it is funny how you cannot like your sister for a period of time, but you still love them. And the love is palpable. Mm-hmm. And that need to protect, which doesn't have to go hand in hand with liking them. And, you know, I think that I wanted to get an essence of that in the book, and the complexity of that relationship, because that's what makes it so special, I think.
Do you know, it's funny. I have a sister who is 13 months younger than I am. And I always wanted a brother, but I wanted a brother between us. So, you know, biologically that was never going to happen, but I was always pushing for a little brother. And I think it's because you realize the relationship with your sister is one way, and a relationship with a brother would be something different. And I always wanted a little brother. That and a country squire station wagon. If my mother's watching this, I still want the station wagon with the wood on the side. You know, there are little things from childhood that you just didn't get. You didn't get the brother or the station wagon, because we didn't have a big enough family for the station wagon. But if we got the brother, it would have been big enough. That's the way I saw it.
It all would have worked out.
so funny. So our reviewer, Ray Palin, who gave this a glowing review last week, had this to say: there are a lot of juicy occurrences here that will make you question everything that has happened and what we have read in Rose's journal entries. The finale is a wild one with plenty of unexpected plot twists along the way. So my first question is, we're not going to talk about this ending because we can't give anything away. Did you know the ending and write to it, or did that happen somewhere in the middle or along the way?
Some of it. I whenever I answer questions about process and plot, it always seems to come out a little bit different because my plot, my process is so chaotic, you know, and it doesn't feel like it should be, because for this book and for other books, I've used a spreadsheet, you know. I mean, how unwriterly is that? Where I'll put in, you know, not every scene, but what I think is going to happen along the way and in whose perspective, which always makes me think, how can things happen that I don't expect? But in fact, when you're writing a whole book, it's so different from writing, you know, in the cell of a spreadsheet, and characters grow and change in ways that you don't expect. You start writing and for me, I'm very easily bored. And so if I find myself bored while writing my own book, I always think, well, that's bad. Something, you know, we're going to have to change this up a little bit. And so there is something that happens in the very last chapter that I didn't know I was going to write until I wrote it.
Okay,
and then I thought, oh, okay. And that was fun. But there were things that I knew would happen along the way, and I think more or less the way things ended with Fern was what I expected. But yeah, there were definitely twists and turns along the way as I wrote the draft, but also as I kind of rewrote and tried to kind of clean up things, I then think, oh, actually this might work better, and oh, you know, that I worked through a number of drafts and I'm constantly looking for ways to tighten, make better. And by the end, it doesn't resemble my spreadsheet at all. So I don't know. If anyone knows a better process, please just slide into my DMs.
What we could also do is some authors will have, you know, their works that will be, here all their writing. Here are my spreadsheets about how I wrote my books. Here, you can, for the collection at the library, here are all the spreadsheets of how I wrote my books. Yes. Yes, you're married to an accountant. We got that now. We totally figured that out. So Rose's parts of the books are shared in journal entries where Ferns are in the first person. So tell us why you chose that form for telling the story, because it completely works, but it's very different. It's very different from things I've read.
Yeah. Well, look, one of the things that I was interested in, not just in this book, but in previous books, is looking at perspectives and how they can be different of this, you know, the perspective of the same event. And I think that is one of the best ways that as human beings we can create empathy, if you look at the exact same scene from another character's perspective. Mm-hmm. And so in this book, and with Rose and Fern, I knew I wanted to go into both characters' point of view. And in itself, you know, that would have been interesting because they're twins. And what, I mean, they've had the same childhood, the same kind of nature and nurture, and so to look at how they have experienced the same thing is a really interesting exercise to me. But then I thought, well, to add a dimension to that, sorry about my dog snoring, it's getting loud now, to add another dimension to that, what about if we threw in someone's perspective? So obviously in Fern's perspective, we're living the events as she lives them. We're in her shoes, we're seeing through her eyes, and we can draw our own conclusions. But by having the journal entries for Rose, we were adding that third color, which was, this is what Rose is telling us happened. You know, this is how she perceived that event. This is what she thinks. And I thought that A, helped to make the characters a bit more distinctive, but it also added that third side of the truth, you know, your version, my version, and what happened. And I loved playing with that for this book because it really, I find that interesting as a human being, but also it helped to kind of, as you read the book, you think, oh, these chronology, these versions don't match up, you know. Mm-hmm. Is someone lying? Are they both true? Is that possible? If someone's lying, who's lying? And I love to have those questions in a reader's mind as they're reading.
Yeah, and it completely works because we only see how she's presenting herself, whereas Fern interacts with other people, and Rose is giving you her story, and this is who I am, and this is what's going on with Owen, my husband, and this is what's happening, and you believe her truth because she's telling it to you, and you believe her truth also because her sister is a little bit more unreliable in a lot of ways and very, very dependent on her. So that was really the, to me, that was always the dynamic in the writing was who's representing which version of the truth? And is there a, is there real truth? And you were going back and forth.
It totally
worked. So in our last interview, you told me that you liked writing more than editing. Has that changed or is it still that way?
No, in fact, I've just been given the copy edit for my next book, which is coming out next year, and I've been dragging my feet on it. I open it up and I think, oh, no, I'm just going to do another interview because it's been, you know, I've been doing lots of interviews this week, but it's not my favorite, I have to say. I love creating the characters. I love that early stage where you're seeing if a book is coming together and you're starting to find out backstory and you're hopefully starting to think, I think there's a book here. Editing can be good. I mean, there are some wonderful moments where an editor will pick up something that could really strengthen the book. And you think, first you think, I'm an idiot. Why did I not see that? You know, and then you think, thank goodness for you, because I, you know, I could have left this big plot hole, or I could have done this, you know, book that wasn't quite as good. So there's definitely moments like that. And when I get into the zone, it can be pleasurable to edit. But yeah, it's, I think forever drafting will be my first love.
Drafting is your first love. Let's just keep drafting and drafting and drafting, especially. And, you know, it's also, you're at that point where you've got the copy edits, but you're doing, you're still talking about this other book. So it's okay. Let me go talk about this and then go back to that book. And this is the book you worked on a year ago or like, you know, however long ago. And it's still fresh in your head because you're talking about it again, but it's like, wait a second, I have to go do this other complete thing. And how am I going to talk about that next year? You know?
And I'm also starting to come up with the idea for the next book, and I'm sort of thrashing that out. And, you know, it is funny that you do remember. I often joke that I'll think, you know, who's Fern? You know, I'm not. But you do. They're such a big part of your life. And you, especially Fern, was just so close to my heart. And I remember everything that she did and said in that book. But I have had experiences where I have done I've visited a book club who have been reading one of my books that have been from a few years before. And once or twice, I'll admit, they've been talking about a character and I thought, who is that again? When I'm five books down the line.
I've heard that from so many authors. They said they're talking and you're like, wow, that person sounds really interesting. Wow, that's really, and that happened in the book too? Whoa, that's a really good book. Oh, that's my book, you know? It's like, wow, that was really, and somebody will come over and go, I think this was really clever, the way you played this through. And I'm like, yeah, that was a really clever thing, whoever that person was. You
know? I know. I love it when readers will say something that you completely didn't intend, but that makes you sound really smart. And then often I'll say, yes, thank you. I'm glad that you picked that up. And then I'll go and tell everyone else that that's what I meant. So readers are wonderful in that way, making us look better than we are.
So when you're writing, okay, you do your first draft. When does your agent or your editor see it? Like, who sees it next? Does Rob, your agent, see it next? Does Jen see it next? Who's next?
Usually Rob and Jen will get it together. My agent and my publisher, but I will do several drafts before it gets to that point, because it would just be too humiliating to send them an early draft, because then they would cancel my contract and never want to speak to me again. So generally I will do, the first draft is where I kind of get that spreadsheet thing, whatever I've had in the spreadsheet, and I kind of put it into the basic form of a book. It may not even have full scenes in it. It usually has thrashed out dialogue, a bit of scene setting, but sometimes I'll end it with end scene somehow.
Okay.
And something ominous must happen here, or, you know, but more or less it's a book, but a very quickly written book. And then the next draft will be about really populating that and, you know, building on what is there, stopping the characters from being talking heads and actually, you know, injecting some personality. Although Fern is one of the ones that her personality came out straight away. I didn't have to do much of that with her, but in general. And then the next draft is really about pulling that apart and putting it back together again, you know, really looking at what's working and what's not working. And, you know, I think that there's an extra character that we didn't need. Let's pull him out and we can tighten that up. A bit of surgery happens on that third draft. And then the fourth draft is really about smoothing all of that in, making sure that after that surgery, everything still hangs together and is in the right place. And then I might send it to Jen and Rob then. But then it's a back and forth. I also have publishers in Australia who actually usually get it at the same time. And everyone will have thoughts and feelings about it. I'll get lots of notes back and then I'll go again. And then I might send it back and there might be a few more thoughts, might go again. So it's just, for me, it's about that kind of chiseling. I've got my chiseling thing out and it's just about really getting to the guts of what I'm trying to talk about. And it starts as a big, you know, gnarly, ugly draft, and it's just getting it closer and closer and more polished into what I hope that it will be.
Right. And you know what I really love is if you get to a point where you don't know what you're going to be, just put needs better ending here, needs better here or there instead, and then just keep writing and then go back and fill in what's going on, as opposed to some people that like it's got to be perfect as you're going. And I think that, you know, a lot of readers don't realize how many times an author reads their book. Like we read it once, maybe twice. If it's your favorite book, you read it once a year. But how many times you read that book and how many times you're looking at that prose, and we're not just talking about first draft, second draft, copy, edits, whatever, all along the way of what you're doing. And people said that they finally sometimes read the final book and they're like, I still could have changed that word there. I can't do it, but I could change that word right there. Change that for the paperback. Yeah.
Oh, I could, and I've been speaking to other authors recently who have actually been the audio, the narrator of their audiobook. And people have asked, would I like to do that? And I have said, no, I would not. That would be a horrendous job for exactly that reason, is that imagine it's published and it's printed. And I think that I could not be trusted to not just change it a little bit and cut out those words or change those words. And the second thing I thought, when people ask me that, is I don't know if I should be offended that they've never asked me. But no, I would say no.
I think your first answer is the right one, because I do know people who've narrated their own books and they said it's really hard because you're reading this like, why did I write that? And you also start to hear the same word that you've used over and over. It's like, here we are again. Why am I saying that? Now I must speak it again. And it's like, they said it's sort of like being in detention, because you have to keep saying the word that you said like 23 times in the book over.
It's an exercise of pure self-loathing, I think. That's all it could be.
So you're so much fun to follow on Instagram. I have a blast following you, your family, whatever. And I think you enjoy doing it too. What works for you about being on Instagram? What do you like about it?
Gosh, that's a good question. What do I like about it? I've been on Instagram for a number of years now, but I really stepped it up when we were in lockdown last year. And I think that was just because the craziness of the inside of my house was just so much that I needed to share it with people, and particularly my little daughter, Clementine, so there's my husband and I, and then we have two school age children. And then we have Clementine, who was three last year. And we were all working and the kids were at schooling, and Clementine is not at school yet. So she just roamed the house all day long with no structure or, you know, really any parenting. And so she would just, every time I went into the kitchen, there'd be a chair pushed up to the, you know, the pantry, and she will have just got down some crackers for lunch. And, you know, it was just such a wild, funny time. And so I really started by just getting little videos of her and what she was doing, because it was so funny. And then Christian, my husband, who was doing most of the homeschooling, he started to go a bit mad, like we all did, and was just saying these really funny things about, you know, he was getting philosophical about life. And so I started filming that, and it kind of became this inside, like, reality TV show about my family in a way. And alongside that, people started sending me clothes, which I'm a big clothes person. I love fashion, and it seems so ridiculous because we were in lockdown and everyone was in, you know, pajamas. But first of all, one clothing store, which I love, sent me a sweater, we call them jumpers, And I wore it when I was just, you know, talking about writing is the other thing I do on Instagram. And the jumper sold out. And so after that, I have just been sent all these clothes, which is amazing. I'm like, wonderful. Please keep sending me clothes. And so really, it's become this way to connect with readers, connect with people. I really enjoy when people say things to me like, thank you for not projecting this aspirational kind of image where everything is perfect and your children are well behaved and, you know, your house isn't messy and all of those things. And it's not intentional. This is just my life uncut, you know, this is just how we roll. But I do like to kind of give the other a bit of a more scrappy version of Instagram where I don't want to make anyone feel bad. My goal, like it is with my books, is to entertain people and make them laugh and make them feel and make them feel a bit of connection. And so in a way, the social media is just an extension of that.
Yeah. And we want to adopt Clementine over here. We want her at our house. We want her coming to visit. You come on tour, you bring her to us, because there are certain videos. And if you go on her Instagram page, you're going to see exactly what it is. There are certain videos of her that will make you laugh so hard because it is true. She's just like a little feral child walking through the house, but she's like running the show. And it is so funny to watch her in different situations, but she's like a storybook character in a lot of ways, but it's her being her. And it just makes what you're doing in your books feel that much more real, because you feel like you're just plucking it from, it's not, let's put it like, some people on Instagram, it's all airbrushed and perfect. Here, it's just, this is real. This is really what our lives are like. And this is really what we're going to do. And I love everyone's doing their schoolwork, everything. And she's just like all over the house. And it's so perfect.
Yes.
Because that's what people's lives are. That's what people's lives really are.
I mean, that's what everyone I know, you know, life was like. So I don't know who's got these airbrushed lives, but it's not anyone that I know. But it's funny because Clementine also has this really curly hair, and which we don't know where it came from. No one else has curly hair in our family, but she won't let us brush it. And so she really did kind of look like a homeless child wandering around the house. Often she's, you know, half nude because she just decided she wasn't going to wear pants, and this wild hair, and just, you know, putting my lipstick all over her face, or, you know, she's just forever getting into trouble. And she reminds me of the character Fancy Nancy. Do you have those books?
Yes, definitely. And I also like the way she gets herself out of situations too. Like, no, did that happen? Really? I'm not sure. How could that have happened? I don't understand. What could it have happened? It's just like she does her own stand-up monologue and she doesn't even know that's what she's doing. But she's like... And everyone else is going on with their lives. And she's like, well, this one, you know, it's so perfect. And, you know, also children never cry, get upset, or do anything wrong on Instagram. Like, I don't understand. Like, every child is like so perfect. And she definitely has her own personality comes through on every single level. And it's like really refreshing as opposed to, oh my gosh, they're all so, I just watch these children. I'm like, my gosh, my kids growing up, it was never all like that. It was moments like that, but not that perfect ever, you know?
No, I even struggle to get perfect moments, to be honest. It's just a big shit show all over the house. But gosh, we laugh. And I like to share the laughs. And with Clementine, she, as I said, there's 5 years between my middle child and her. And she is just that much younger child. You know, we all knew someone who was the much younger child who wasn't really parented and who, you know, just had to kick on after their brother and sister. And they were always the best ones. You know, they were just the funniest, wildest, most free spirit. And, you know, that's what we have with her.
Well, I tell you, lockdown was so serious in Australia that you couldn't even have the nanny come. You couldn't have the babysitter in the house. And it's just, they're like, okay, you've spawned these children. They're yours. It's everything to do. If you've got a deadline, tough luck. You still have your child to deal with, you know?
It was the great leveler. Like, we were seeing Australian celebrities, you know, and you couldn't leave your house. You could leave the house for 1 hour a day to go to the grocery store or to do exercise. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, it was fun. Like, you could really look at these A-listers and they're stuck with their kids trying to homeschool them. So, you know, that was a fun side of things.
Yeah, homeschooling. It was a whole other world. Now, recently, Your husband got his own Instagram account. Now, what is his Instagram name? Because I just love this.
He is at Mr. Sally Hepworth. And that was his choice to call himself that. And it was after last year in lockdown, he amazingly really loved being at home with us all the time, because before that he had quite a busy job and he was working in the city. And even though he seemed to lose his mind a little bit, he came back home in January this year and said, I think I'd like to stay home and you know, be, as we call him, COO of the kids. I'm CEO still.
Still CEO.
But he's the chief operating officer. And Clementine will go to school next year. And he said, I'd love to just have a year at home and maybe beyond. So he is now the COO, and he has his Instagram page where he just kind of, you know, gives us the daily life of his new life. So that's fun too.
The things that he has to do, because he's definitely got a good game going on there too. And next year when she goes to school, he may be spending some more time at school too, besides going and getting her back and forth. You know? It's like, this is what I'm going to do.
Exactly.
We've talked about in the past that you tell me you're an introvert, which you never think about looking at you on social media. Is it make it easier for you to be outgoing on social media? Because you don't seem introverted at all.
Yeah. It's so funny because I've met a lot of introverts like me more recently, and often Instagram is, or, you know, any social media is a really good platform for introverts because it's on our terms. And, you know, I think the most terrifying thing for an introvert is small talk, you know, when you're stuck at a cocktail party and you don't really know many people. And so the whole kind of format of it is making small talk. You're not really getting to that. I like real talk, you know. The way that as women we bond with each other is, you know, if you're standing in an elevator with someone and they tell you that, you know, their dress just blew up and, you know, people saw their underwear, or, you know, whatever that may be, something vulnerable helps women connect, and I love that. But that kind of, what do you do? Tell me about yourself. I find that really hard. I feel really self-conscious about it. I get very easily bored as well, which is kind of, you know, I find that difficult. But when I'm in this kind of situation, when I'm talking about something that I know, you know, I know about my books and my life, so that is okay for me. And we're having real talk now, you know, we're talking about things that I care about and that you care about and that, that we do for our job. And so in that way, yeah, Instagram is me talking about things that I love and I know without kind of having to be in that area that makes me uncomfortable, which is, you know, surrounded by a lot of people. I also realized through my children's diagnoses that I think I have a bit of sensory processing disorder, because I, and my girlfriends all know this about me, when we get together, it's always dinner. It's not drinks, or I don't go dancing, and it has to be quiet. I love to talk to my friends one-on-one, and but I can't do nightclubs, never could. And when the noise gets to a certain level, I shut down a little bit and I just have to leave. So there are a number of things at play. I love people. Introversion isn't about not liking people. It's just about at what point it takes more out of you than you're getting back from it. So I think social media is wonderful for introverts, and a lot of friendly people you'll find on there.
Well, my mother will tell you that, like, I used to say, I want to have a friend over when I was little, and the friend would come over and then I wouldn't want to play with the friend anymore. I'd go off and go do my thing, because it was like, oh, if they're not going to do this or that or the other thing. And my mother would go, but we have this child here that you wanted to have over. And I was like, the concept was better than having to actually entertain the entire time. You know, it was like, oh, we're going to do these things. And then now what are we going to do? We're going to just chit chat? No. Let's go do something.
That was me. Exactly the same. Yeah.
It's like, no, not really into this. Are you still doing meetings with book clubs, like virtually at this point? Are you still doing those?
Yes, I'm pretty much fully booked for the next few months. I have a couple of little slots. I did have someone yesterday that I was able to slot in. But I have, so, you know, get in touch if you're watching, but I'm pretty much fully booked now. just with little spots here and there. But I've said to a few people that if their book club is reading the book, then I can always just pop in and quickly say hi via Zoom, even if I can't completely stay and take a lot of questions. But it's been a super fun piece of having books published. And I did it in Australia as well when the book came out, being able to hear from people who've read it, because, you know, isn't that why we do it? You know, we want people to read it and hear what they think. So I love it, but it is something that's getting more popular and it's starting to book out.
Yeah, it starts becoming time consuming too. It's time consuming to go and do that, you know, turn on blah, 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 blah. So was The Good Sister always the title of this book? Was this always going to be The Good Sister?
No, when I wrote it, I called it Fern.
Really?
I don't think that was the right title for the book, but it was a working title. And that was testament to the fact that really this book is about Fern. And it is about sisters, of course, and Rose has her point of view, but Fern's the heart and soul of this book. And it was about her life, and the character of Fern came to me, and it was a lovely book in that way. Some books are harder than others to write. And this one, Fern makes the book, I think.
Yes,
so it was called Fern. But then I kind of sent it to my publishers called Fern, knowing that it would change, because I'm not sure if that title would work for a book. And we went back and forth. I think we settled on a different title, which I wish I could remember. And might have been The Other Sister, or it was something sisterly, and then it just wasn't quite right, and I was sitting on it, and then Jen, my publisher, emailed with, you know, I was just thinking it didn't feel right, what about The Good Sister? And we immediately said yes, that's the title. So I was happy with that.
And when you nail it, you sit there and say, well, how could it not have been that? That's the perfect title.
I know.
How did we never come up with that earlier? Why was that? And
exactly.
I love the cover. Was this the first design of the cover? Was this the original, the way everybody looked at the cover?
I think it was. I'm going back a little bit. I'm pretty sure it was. So this is the US cover. And if you look at it, it's got roses and ferns. Isn't that just so beautiful? The woman in the window.
I hadn't noticed that. Yeah. But I had both of those. That's great.
I know, it's so beautiful. And they've got the woman in the window, which is a little bit reminiscent of the mother-in-law, which had a woman in the window. I think it really kind of conveys what is in the book, which is the light and the shade, you know, of the funny, heartwarming side of the book, but also the sinister side. You know, it's like this funny, heartwarming colour, and then this is sinister. So,
And then you've got the line. And then there's the tagline, everyone has a dark side. So if Caseless Flowers were throwing you off on the bottom, just read that line and you know someone's got a dark side. Everyone does. Whose dark side are we dealing with in the window?
Exactly. Exactly. That's the question.
So now what did the Australian cover look like? Because it was completely different, because I remember seeing that on social media.
That's the Australian cover, which I also love. And I love the color. I think the paper dolls have got, like, they're sort of cutesy, but they've also got a sinister vibe, and I think that the font here as well gives off a sinister vibe. And there are also roses and ferns, if you see which I love. And I think that I love them both, and it's funny because they're so different, but I think that they both do a great job of really conveying the book, and I've had great response to both covers.
So now Australia, a US, and then there will be a UK edition, like there's a completely different UK. And when's the UK book out?
It's out. It came out on the 15th, and they do have a cover, but it just hasn't got here yet. All the post has been slow, but I have seen it online, and it's more this vibe than that.
More that vibe. I like your wall behind you with all your covers up there. That's beautiful. It's like,
thank you.
It's my own bookstore.
I know, my son said to me yesterday, did you need to buy that many copies of your own book?
I love it.
I didn't buy them, but good point, son.
You can sit there and say, yes, I did have to do that. And now you're not having dinner just because of that. We don't have any money for dinner because we have all this book. Would you like to buy one and you can have dinner? You know, just do that. That would totally throw him.
This is the only reason we made it onto the New York Times bestseller list, because I bought all the copies.
You bought all the copies and have them shipped to Australia. You know what I mean? There. That's exactly what you did. The truth is that. Dagger next to the title. So Barry Krynick once again does a great job of narrating the audiobook. And I feel like she's become the voice of your work because she's done a lot of your books. Have you ever met or spoken with her along the way?
I have. Well, I met her when I was in New York, not the time that we met, but before that, when The Family Next Door came out. And we actually have got an interview that we did with each other, I think, at the end of the audio of The Family Next Door. She is fantastic. And she actually narrates the books with an Australian accent. And I've never heard anyone do such a perfect Australian accent, because it's hard to do. It's a hard accent. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky enough on Monday this week to do an interview with Barry and a group called The Walking Book Club, who exclusively read audiobooks, and each month they have the author and the narrator interviewed. And so I could have talked to her all day. She records them, well, since COVID, in a closet in her parents' house, you know, under a blanket. And she is, the funny thing is that she did her first Australian accent narration for my book, The Family Next Door. And since then, she has got a bit of a niche, and she said she'd done something like 25 books because she's now known for her Australian accent. So that was, I felt quite proud of that. We got her accent sounding good.
Totally. But I love sitting in the floor of the closet with everything around her, like no producer, just sit there and do it. And, you know, I don't think people realize I'm emceeing an event with narrators this weekend for the Newburyport Book Festival, and just going to talk to them about their work, how they do it. And I think that people don't realize how tough this is to do, because you can say a word wrong, you can lisp, you can swallow wrong. All these things will sound up as sounds and blips on the narration that, besides getting, and I know people have reached out to the author to say, how do you say this word? How would you do this? Yeah. How would you do that? But I think that people really don't realize how hard it is to be the narrator, and to be doing it in the closet without a producer, really tough, because you're actually self-editing them.
They are my heroes. I have never thought that it would be easy, and I've always thought, wow, hats off, because it's incredible. But it was a good interview, and Barry talks about how she does it, and I had lots of questions for her. So I'm sure your interview will be amazing.
I want to find that interview with her, though. That would be really fun to listen to, because I just love how people do different parts of the craft. It's like, in a person who creates the cover, the person who does the copy editing. And I mean, one person was saying they keep taking the commas out, I keep putting them back in. They keep doing this, and I want it that way. And it's just all these discussions that go on behind the scenes when you're writing a book, that it's not just cut and dry. It's all these different things.
Exactly.
So you've done a lot of interviews via Zoom. I mean, we know that it's tomorrow in Australia. This is always good. Has that been helpful this time? Like, what do you miss about in person, besides being able, I mean, now you can reach a lot more people, because you couldn't spend that much time here in the States. The children would miss you. So as a result, are you able to do a lot more with virtual, or what's happening?
Yeah, look, it's been great. And I'll preface that by saying there's nothing like being somewhere in person. Because you get to meet readers in person. I think that is just an unbelievable gift to be able to do that, especially when they are on the other side of the world from me, to be able to kind of see an actual human, and they have read my book and enjoyed it, for me is just the most wonderful thing. And I think for me as a reader, when I have been able to meet, you know, I've met Jodie Picoult and Leanne Moriarty, and I mean, it's just, you feel a new bond with them when you've actually got to meet them in person. And in my case, I also get to catch up with my editors and my marketing people and the people I deal with every day. Nothing beats in person for that. That said, I have had the best couple of weeks doing interviews with the American people. I'm able to, you know, come down first thing in the morning, which is, you know, your evening. So I'm on and I can just chat, And, you know, and then, yes, because of Zoom, we can then have a product that can be shared. So many people can see it. It's a wonderful thing for getting word out there about books. I'm able to speak to people that I wouldn't have been able to speak to otherwise. There's definitely pros and cons. And I think moving forward, whether or not travel opens up again and I'm able to travel, this will continue to be a piece of it. And I mean, it's an amazing piece. I when I can get the tech right, then I love it.
That's the scariest bit. I think that we've been able to see so many more authors this year. I've seen, you know, certain people, I've seen them do more than one interview because nothing is exactly the same. You'll learn something different by the way they're connecting with whoever's interviewing them or whatever. But I find I've really enjoyed it. I mean, there are a lot of evenings that I'm going, like, you know, skipping from one event to the next. And then it's fun because we've been doing this thing called Bookachino Live, where every the second Wednesday of every month, I actually tell readers what's coming out the next 4 weeks. And we started doing this when lockdown, like, you know, when everybody was home, and then we couldn't get to the bookstore, you couldn't get to the library. So I would tell you what was coming for the next 4 weeks. And we didn't go further than that because my feeling was the only thing you cared about was dinner that night. You didn't care about dinner next week. Like, you just need it now. So we do that. And then we tease a couple of books coming out like 2 months later on. So, you know, this is what we do. And it was so much fun to be able to just sit and do that with a group of readers. And it just kept building of how many people were coming to these events. But also, I could then share little tidbits that I'd heard from doing an interview with an author or hearing them interviewed someplace and layer that in. And the publishers doing interviews in advance with the authors before the books came out. And all of a sudden, there was this more multidimensional story that was going on. I remember the first time we met, it was lunch with a group of bloggers. There were a group of bloggers, and they were all introducing by their handles. They were introducing themselves to you. And it was just this magical experience because they all didn't know each other. You were the conduit for them to all get to know each other and talking about your work. And I just sat back that day and I said, this is amazingly fun to watch this completely different dynamic going.
Oh, I remember that lunch. It was amazing. And I know that a lot of the bloggers have gone on to become friends and I've seen them connecting, you know, online and they have been so supportive to me and the Good Sister. And, you know, I love book lovers and the way that that manifests on Instagram and in the rest of the world. It's wonderful.
It was just really, really fun. I mean, and actually I remember it was not November. November's when we put the podcast up. It was actually July and it was a really super hot day, if I remember correctly.
That's right.
It was about a billion degrees. And we did the interview in our office and we had to turn the air conditioner off. And the two of us were melting, you know, so.
That's right. It was June. I think it was June because it was right. Yeah, it was when I was through Good Morning America. And it was June.
Yes, you flew east to do Good Morning America. I just love that, you know. And I realized you were coming in. I'm like, wait a second, I've got to meet her because last trip I didn't get to meet her. So you figure that out. So when we left off last time, you better come back. Amy Poehler had been tapped to work on the adaptation of The Mother-in-Law. So with Hollywood all locked down, is that still happening but slower, or what's happening?
Exactly. Yeah. Look, last year everything stopped in Hollywood, and but you know we did continue to get updates, and they're continuing to work on it. I've seen a couple of scripts. They've attached a writer. Things are moving forward, and I'm getting updates every few months. So hopefully there'll be more to talk about soon.
I think that everything's going to explode, like all of a sudden. Like all of a sudden, everything is going to like turn the gears back on because so much has been stop, start, stop, start, stop, start. And, you know, there's certain stars that they're committed to like six projects now, but they still want to do the one that was back here. And it's going to be complicating sorting out schedules and stuff, but I think it's going to be very interesting. Yet I do think that this last year was a golden age for books and book reading.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that continues because there was somebody last year that said, oh, like, I don't know what's going to happen. And I was like, wait a second, there's not going to be any TV. Like, there's not gonna be any movies. There's not gonna be enough streaming. They're gonna be holding things back because there's no sports. So I see it as a golden age for books. And I heard of a lot of people rediscovering reading, like they hadn't read in years and they were back doing that too. Again. Yeah. So we shall see. I think it's great. So dare I ask what you're working on now? Do we have any little hints? Is it
Well,
in-laws? What family members now?
Well, the next book is called The Younger Wife, so that gives you a clue with what relationship we're looking at. And I am working on the copy edit for that now. So that book's done and it's been to the editors and we're kind of fine-tuning the line-by-line stuff. But it's about a adult family and the father figure, the patriarch, marries a woman who's the same age as his daughters, and his wife is still alive and she has Alzheimer's, and so it's this kind of really funny, you know, dysfunctional modern family, and something quite sinister happens at the beginning and then, you know, it all kicks off from there.
And really, Sally, something sinister? Like, you write those books that something sinister happened? No, I'd be shocked. I'm absolutely shocked that that would be happening in a Sally Hepworth book. I mean, really, these people are all these like family-minded people. Everything's great. These sisters, I mean, they love each other.
Yes, exactly. And
sisters,
I like
a
dead body.
Oh, it's dead body.
I'm like a dead body in the first chapter. Otherwise, I don't feel like I'm doing my job.
See, there we go. There we go. Well, it's, well, we look forward to seeing you do your job again, because now I've read this
Thank
one,
you.
So I figure like, well, maybe I have like 9 months before I get to read another one. We'll see. We'll see.
We'll see. My job's almost done. So then it depends how long it takes for them to get arcs, but make sure you're top of the list.
Oh, because then I put everything else aside. And it's really funny because I take all these notes in the book because I realize I'm not going to talk to you right away. So I have to remember. So this morning I was going through the pages I folded down, and it's amazing how much of the story completely came back to me. You know, there are, perfectly admit this, there are some thrillers that I don't remember. Like, I really don't remember what happened. Like, I'll go and I was like, wait, who was in that book? What happened? But your characters are so strong that I completely remembered little tiny things that they'd done in the book, like in the library where she went and hid in the room in the back and all these little things. Yeah. I remember those. So that's a real
Thank you. That's so nice to hear.
Well, you come eat and you come and you can bring Clementine on the plane and she can come hang with us. I figure that there would be nothing like a plot. Let's see. Take a flight from Australia to New York with your like 5-year-old. Oh, come on. That's great plot. There's a lot there. Yes.
Someone would die, no doubt. And it wouldn't be Clementine. I'd have to put her on her own plane. I can't even bear to think about that now, but you're right. There'd definitely be a dead body in that book.
There'd be a dead body in that book for sure. So good to talk to you as always. I look forward to seeing you more on Instagram. I really do. I want to see more of what's going on with you and your family and your Writerly Wednesday. She also does Writerly Wednesdays, which is great writing tips. So,
yes. Thank you, Carol. Hopefully see you in the flesh next time.
Hopefully too. And to our readers, we look forward to seeing you next time as well. Thanks everyone for joining us. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from The Good Sister, narrated by Barry Krynick. Coming up after the credits, courtesy of Macmillan Audio.
Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks 2. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time, Book Reporter Talks 2. Thanks to the producer of today's episode, Austin Rue.
And now, here is audio excerpt.
Journal of Rose Ingrid Castle. It's been 3 months since Owen left. Left or left me? Like so many things in the adult world, it's all a bit grey. He took a job in London, a work opportunity ostensibly. It's not that I wasn't invited, but it was clear to both of us that I couldn't go. That's another thing about the adult world. Responsibilities. In my case, one particular responsibility. Fern. But let me backtrack, because it sounds like I'm blaming her. I'm not. The problems between Owen and me are 100% unequivocally entirely my fault. I committed the most cardinal of marital sins. I changed. Overnight, as soon as the clock chimed my 27th birthday, in fact, I went from being a well-educated, empowered woman to one of those pathetic women who wanted a baby with such ferocity it drove my husband away. An ovulation kit wielding, sperm testing, temperature taking lunatic. In my previous life, I'd scorned this type of woman from up in my, what I presumed to be, fertile ivory tower. Then I'd become one. And I'd pushed and I'd pushed and I'd pushed until my husband left. Left or left me. My therapist is right. It is a relief getting these thoughts out of my head and onto paper. In therapy, we hardly talk about Owen at all. Instead, we while away the 50-minute hours talking about my traumatic childhood. According to him, a good way to process trauma and put it behind you is to write it down. That's why he gave me this journal. I'm not convinced it will help, but here I am. Apparently the people pleaser in me dies hard. The obvious place to start is the night at the river. I was 12. We were camping. Mum and Daniel had been dating for about 6 months, but it was the first time we'd been away anywhere together. Daniel brought Billy, much to my and Fern's delight. We'd forever longed for a brother and all those wonderful traits a brother brought with him. Roughhousing, logical arguments, and good-looking friends. And for the first few days, we had a good time. Better than good. It was the closest I'd ever come to being part of a normal family. Daniel taught us to fish. Billy taught us how to play poker. And Mum? She was like a completely different person. She did things like remind us to apply sunscreen and tell us to be careful in the river because the current could be strong. One day she even rested her arm affectionately around my shoulders as we sat by the fire. She'd never done that before. I'll never forget what it felt like, our bodies touching like that. On the last night, Billy, Fern and I went to the river mouth. The heat of the day hung in the air, and we spent most of the time slapping mosquitoes from our arms. Billy was in the water, the only place to get any relief from the heat. Usually Fern and I would have joined him, but something was up with Fern that night. She was in one of her moods. I'd wanted to ask her about it all day, but Fern could be volatile when she was upset. I decided it was better to leave it alone. We'd been by the river an hour or so when nature called. Billy was showing no signs of getting out of the water, so I headed deep into the trees. There was no way I was going to let him see me pee. It was slow going. It was pitch black and I was barefoot. I had to watch every step I took. My fear of snakes didn't help matters. Still, I was gone for 5 minutes max. Apparently, that is all it takes. When I returned to the river, Fern was gone. Fern, I called. Where are you? It was strange for her not to be in the spot I left her. It took me a minute to locate her, illuminated by a patch of moonlight in the shallows of the river. She was standing eerily still. Billy was nowhere to be seen. What are you? I took a step toward her and she lifted her hands. Before I could ask what was going on, something rose to the surface of the water beside her, a sliver of pale, unmoving flesh. Fern, I whispered. What have you done?
Thank you for listening to this clip provided to you by Macmillan Audio. To hear more, look for this title wherever audiobooks are sold.